Welcome to the second Legends of Tomorrow Flashcast. I'm Lisa Schmeiser, and with me tonight are Dan Morin.
Hello.
And Tony Sindelar.
Also, hello, nerds.
Ah, there you go. I was like, aren't you forgetting something? And we're here to discuss the episode that aired on Monday, October 30th. This episode had everything. It had men being turned into pigs. It had people sleepwalking to offices. It had father-son conflict. It had the Salem witch trials. And I can't wait to get started. How about you guys?
Yeah. I'm good. This show had everything.
Everything.
Yes. So I feel like I don't know what this show has, but they are leaning hard into it. And that is my favorite form of television, when it's like, we may not be the best, but the thing we are going to be that 110%.
We are the most Legends of Tomorrow.
We are the most Legends of Tomorrow. Yeah, I do not need, we are the 40% Flash show. I do not need, we are like 65% of Super Friends. I need 110% of Legends of Tomorrow.
So. And I feel like we got that in many, many ways. So people who follow our Flashcasts know that typically we recap an episode and then we move into discussing it and or returning to regular segments. Tony and I, when we were on Flashcasts, had our gimmick where we tried to recap the episode in under 45 seconds, was it? But the point is, it was a speedy show, so we tried to recap it speedily. I am open for keeping that format now, or perhaps going to some sort of epic saga, since Legend seems to be leaning hard into fairy tales, too.
Once upon a time.
That was how I was going to start tonight. So if somebody wants to lead off, we'll see how long this takes me.
You're good to go, as far as I'm concerned.
All right. I'm gonna time myself then. And 1, 2, 3. All right. Once upon a time, there was a man named John Constantine who was reluctantly teaming up with Legends of Tomorrow because he's running from some sort of big bad that we haven't heard about. But it's so bad that creatures from hell who have found themselves in the middle of Salem during the witch trial hysteria would rather take their chances with that than to partner up with him. Anyway, A-plot this week takes place in Salem when the witch hysteria is amplified by the presence of a doting motherly fairy godmother who's really just there to make sure everybody burns. So our A-team gets into that. The B-plot involves Nate, still in 2018, still trying to mend things with his dad, somehow living at the Time Bureau, and we find out he's got a freakishly good ability at schmoozing and getting funding. The B-plot ends with Ava offering him a job at the Time Bureau. So I have thoughts, or rather I have questions about this. I hope we can bottom out. And as for C-plot, again, it's John Constantine trying to fit in on the ship. Mick is not having it. He's having a very hard time with the new Ruby.
Yeah.
There we go. Other dangling plot threads. Zari is probably going to be grappling with what she can do to save her mom or not this season. John Constantine, I have a feeling that his whole "someone needs to save me from the big bad" will be a big overarching plot this season. And one thing I want to raise as something to look out for: how is Rey going to take being persistently abandoned? Because first it was Kendra who flies off to be with her boring Hawkman, and now it's his eager dork bestie who's staying in 2018 and working on his relationship with his dad. I don't know, you guys. Anyway, that was the episode. Perhaps the highlight of the episode was when the vengeful fairy godmother turned Rory and Ray into pigs. Guess which one ended up in the commissary.
I think there's some strong contention for best moment in this episode. I will vote for the fairy godmother singing in her kind of introductory scene. That was my the musical number was.
That's a good one. I do like the montage of Constantine and Mick everywhere
as roommates.
I enjoyed that, and I also say runner up as Nate talking to Pig Ray and somehow understanding every single thing he is saying.
That was just delightful that he understood him.
They don't even address it. They just go with it.
I know. I think Ray had a couple good.
He's a historian.
Pig historian.
I think when you get your PhD in history, you are required to master a few different foreign languages.
Well, Pig Latin.
Yeah.
Ba-dum-bum. I'm out.
Peace. It's been real.
This podcast is over.
It's going to take a jump ship right off this program.
The the one that I also liked was when Ray like says cheerfully, "Well, we need a combination of mythology and mystery." I was thinking mystery, and he gets like this huge grin, and everyone else is like, "No, no, we're not doing that." And then Sarah tries to do her send off, and she's like, "Too much," and I was like, "Yeah, it's too much." And I kind of like that meta moment because they had set up in like season three. We just had they had set up in season three how she sends them off with a quip or whatever, and they like even flagged it as a problem in the episode where she gets possessed when she's like, "Mama's tired, I don't have anything today." And then Sarah does her attempted send off this time, and I was like, "No." I liked that commentary too. So let's see what else stands out for you guys this week was as far as good moments.
I continue to just enjoy having John Constantine around, right?
Yes.
He's the roommate stuff with Nate, and just him on the team in general, is enjoyable and is a welcome addition to the show. Yeah. So
his refusal to wear a costume.
Yes. which I was like, I mean, are any of them really wearing costumes? It's just, I mean, John, you're wearing like the same trench coat and tie that you wear everywhere. That's basically a costume. So
his trench coat looks so impurely clean.
Massachusetts, no one really cares.
Yeah, I mean, he'll just mutter something and wave his fingers around, and they'll know. So one thing occurred to me when he was busy sending the fairy godmother. So, first of all, I love his antipathy towards the fairy godmother. I loved how it was like just ceaseless insults out of his mouth. He had nothing but contempt for her. It was a completely antagonistic relationship between the two of them. And the explanation of the fairy godmother and how it's like a parasitic relationship with the person she's granting wishes to, creepy and delightful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I loved that.
Great casting too. I mean, she felt like she had fallen out of a Disney movie and transformed from animation into live person.
Yeah, she really had that whole like Angela Lansbury thing going on.
Yeah, they really cast somebody who looked like she could have come out of Cinderella with the cloak and all. But the other thing that occurred to me is it's got to be hard for Matt Ryan to do all those really dramatic gestures where he's, you know, drawing pentagrams in the air and opening the portal. And I thought to myself, is there ever a point where the actors are doing this stuff and just waving their hands around and they're like, "This is ridiculous. How do I make a living, you know?"
I assume every episode
waving my arms
do that.
In circles.
Yes, they are asking themselves why, like, either how did I get so lucky as to be doing this for my living, or
or where did
I
go
come
wrong?
To? Yeah.
Or maybe they're asking.
I could have been Hamlet.
I could have been Hamlet, and instead I'm hallucinating dead mice.
Been there. Well, not everybody can be Hamlet. So,
No. Yeah. Somebody has to be Laertes.
yeah. They did this. I mean, I really enjoyed this episode. It did feel like perhaps one of the most striking "we don't really know what to do with Mick" episodes, where like he's literally like, "Yeah, I don't want to do this one this week, so I'll be in one montage and that's it."
Well, that's what I was wondering is you go back and you look at older episodes and it seems like there's a whole lot of those where, like, does he just not play well with others, or do they have him on a very limited schedule and so they do
well
that?
It's like the somebody pointed out one of the recaps I was reading, or maybe it was a question to the TV news site I'm reading, that Jesse L. Martin on The Flash has done all his scenes were in like sitting down in houses.
Yeah, he has back
and
problems.
And it turns out he has back problem and now he can't be on the show as much. So it's like, maybe, who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe Dominic Purcell is just like really angry and punches extras. No one knows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or he's got like severe anxiety. I don't know. You know, there may be a perfectly plausible explanation. The other thing is I'm trying to figure out if Nick Zano, who...
Yes. This is a question I had.
Are they trying to ease him off the show, or does he have like another project going on, or
it's
budgetary considerations?
It strikes me as a weird choice to have him at the Time Bureau, in part because, as we discussed last week, like his relationship with Ray is such a big part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
That it
also
seems weird.
It feels like the Time Bureau is boring. Like, right, I mean, the episode this week was about them getting funding. And, you know, there was fun to be had there, but probably there's not going to be fun to had there week. Yeah. Week in, week out.
I don't want to watch the Office Time Bureau version.
Right.
And, you know what? When you say it that way, Lisa, I'm in.
And in addition, like, you know, there's the argument, the resource allocation argument of you've got a guy who can, like, turn into Steel Colossus style. Like, why do you sideline him in paperwork?
Yeah, no.
And he's your historian. It makes zero sense to leave him behind.
It does. And so I was like, I was wondering if there was something going on with the actor where they were like, all right, here's what we'll do is we'll just have you cluster a bunch of your scenes. You'll film and then you'll go off and do whatever it is you need to do. And then you'll come back. And he's like, great. Thank you for being so flexible, or what the deal is. Because the other thing, there are two things here. And like one of them is, I feel like the writing team is dropping the ball. And the other one, I feel like they're laying groundwork for what could be a really interesting thing through the year. But where they're dropping the ball is like his girlfriend is back in 1940, whatever, in Zambezi. He got dumped. He got dumped for the timeline. And this is a guy who doesn't seem to have an especially broken heart. You know, he doesn't. And it was a really big deal, like through all of last season with what was going to happen. Oh, Nate's a threat to the future. No, he's not a threat to the future. And do you flash him with the thing so that they forget about each other? Do you not flash him with the thing? And then she goes back to her village and he's like, don't turn around, don't turn around, and gets back on his ship. And he's not acting like a dude who got dumped, or rather, he's not acting like a dude who did like the right thing and put her on the plane to Casablanca or whatever. Mm-hmm. And instead, he's basically like, well, I'm in 2018. I'm broke. I got dad issues. And
If you want to be charitable, you could say that like his reconnecting with his family is like an outlet from having. No more relationships in that way.
Or it'd be nice if he was like, I can't stand to get back on with you guys because teamwork just doesn't feel right. Like there hasn't been. Perhaps it's inferred. I'd like to see the subtext made text.
Yeah.
That said, I was delighted when we found out that his dad is the guy who's responsible for allocating the funding for the Time Bureau. And
I also like that they didn't play that. I had fully expected what are you doing here? What are you doing here moment, right? Like, and they kind of undercut that because, like, Nate sees him through the conference, like, you know, conference room window and is like, oh, yeah, this must be one of my dad's projects that he never talks about. Like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, that he totally know about the Time Bureau. And I was like, oh, that was a little anticlimactic. but it did give that great moment where he gets to show up with, you know, holding Pig Ray and turn into Steel. Yeah.
Well, I guess it was like the first time his dad had learned about the Time Bureau, though, when he's like, you did what now and you want how much money? And because the reason it made sense for me that it was the first time his dad had heard about it was because otherwise, why would he be busting Nate's balls really hard about having a history degree instead of saying, son, there's a project I'll work on. We'll get you clearance. And I think you could do some real good here. Like.
Yeah, he's failing to use some very obvious nepotism here to, like, you know, like, dude, we could get you an unpaid internship. We could get you a security clearance. This could be your way in.
But this is how those things happen, though. And
yes.
You know, and I say this as somebody who graduated from high school in the DC area. This is how these things happen. And so it makes no sense, especially if this guy's like a career, like a lifer at the DOD. So this has to be the first time he's heard about this. And, you know, I have the feeling that what they're doing is by having Nate, like, take the steps towards repairing his relationship with his dad. Like, that gives us an emotional stake in the relationship. And then later something will happen with his dad.
Right.
Like, I feel like we're getting the groundwork laid for that right now. The same way where we had the groundwork laid with, I'm like dead Victor Garber, and that's I'm blanking on the character's name. Thank you. But you know, Martin got the daughter and the grandkid and the relationship, and then all of a sudden he had the stakes there, and so it was you know, everybody got invested, and they did a great job with that plot. So I wonder if this is the thing where Nate has obviously had like all these family connections between his grandfather and now his dad and now this, and something's going to happen to either disrupt continuity or threaten those relationships. And that'll be like his big dramatic beat this season. Cause it seems like they really are starting to lean more heavily on the themes of family between Zari and Nate. And I think we're going to see more of that, especially as we keep going through the season.
Other things I've been impressed with this season so far is it feels like, while there are tips of the hat and nods to some of the mythology that has come before, they've also avoided getting too bogged down in all the mythology. So, like, you know, Zari, I think it's Zari talking to Sarah this week about, like, people you can't save, right? And, like, in previous seasons, that would have been Sarah going on and on about Laurel not being able to save her. And in this season, we just get kind of like, yeah, it's tough. I've been there, right? Uh-huh. Like, and I feel like that's smart because that is a door that you need to close at some point in order for the show to kind of move on. And it's nice that like everybody who is watching and has followed the show knows exactly what she's talking about, so she doesn't have to say it outright.
Also, it gets confusing if you have to explain it, because it's like, yeah, my sister died, but now there's a doppelganger living her life. So
that's yeah. some other show. Never mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's confusing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to say is that I'm trying to figure out what the policy is this season on the whole, like, disrupting the timeline, because in this mm-hmm. episode, we specifically have the woman in Salem who is, according to the historical record,
dead.
Killed.
Yes.
And they mm-hmm. just sort of like, we can't let her go. And at the end, they're like, yeah, we'll just let her go.
No, well
there's one line that she has to leave.
They mentioned that after she got, they mentioned, like, because in the historical timelines, like, she gets killed and then the whole village gets wiped out. And so that was like your ripple in the timeline. And then they're like, well, she does have to die. And I'm like, wait, what? Why? No, Salem doesn't get wiped out in a firestorm later.
I thought that was the anachronism or whatever, but unclear. It was a little fuzzy.
I mean, I think Zari has one line about, like, yeah, well, you can't live here anymore because you died, yeah, that, so you have to change.
That'll fix.
So
everything.
we have to put in a change of address to cover up the timeline.
I mean, it doesn't matter. There's a person running around who shouldn't be alive. Like, that.
Yeah, just this, like, you know, don't have any famous children.
It's like they kind of did that with Helen of Troy, so I don't know why Zari isn't like, well, it worked last year with Helen, we could do it again with these guys.
Just leave everybody on Themyscira.
Yeah, well, that, oh my god, that would actually be an amazing subplot where it turns out that Themyscira is just a massless army of women who would otherwise be burned as witches or whatever.
Or their descendants, right? It's mm-hmm. Helen of Troy and Joan of Arc and just various people that have been dropped off as needed. So
they get pinged every once in a while by somebody.
And then there's one crappy island where they put the dudes. So and it's just, it's just like Napoleon. And it's like, Napoleon, it's your turn to do the dishes. And Napoleon is like, no.
So I think you just described Survivor.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
It's the Oliver Queen Island. Like, it's just
everybody's on Lianyu. That's right. That's right. They got a prison there. It's all set.
Yeah, they never go to the back half of Lianyu that's just covered in TV dinners and old socks.
And dead men from history.
And Napoleon refusing to do the dishes.
Yes.
Genghis Khan trying to ride a goat and failing.
Sorry, I have a soft spot for roommate hijinks humor. It goes back to there was a cartoon, Justice Friends, which was basically legally distinct Hulk, Captain America, and Thor living together as roommates, and, you know, comedy ensues. So it's just taking superheroes and making them deal with the mundane is a source of joy for me. So
do we want to discuss, we talked about a little bit before the show about Gary.
Yes.
Should we do our Gary segment?
So we are going to debut a new segment. Do we want to call it Oh Gary,
Indiana Gary.
Yeah, just Oh Gary, you came and you took without giving. Yes, Oh Gary, because every week I feel the poor guy, like, he's great comic relief, but like every week we find out a new and horrifying detail about him mm-hmm. and his weird, sad life. And, you know, for my nomination for this week's Oh Gary moment is when you find out that he has on occasion sleepwalked to work.
That seems right. That seems plausible. I do have to say, in Gary's defense, that Gary mm-hmm. nails the presentation mostly.
Yeah, it's when he's like, I got bit by a unicorn and took my nipple.
Yes. they need to manage Gary a little better.
He shouldn't have been in that room.
That was a bad decision, but it was Nate panicking. I also really appreciated the time where Nate's dad's like, I just need to be validated, and Gary's like, you're doing a fantastic job.
Oh Gary.
Yeah.
Also, I think at the end when he gives him his parking thing, it's all covered in like validating stickers.
It has way more stickers than are needed to get you. So
I'm looking forward to the eventual, I think, obligatory episode where we learn, why does Gary work at the Time Bureau? Mm-hmm. What were his qualifications? How did he get this job?
It raises a question about the Time Bureau, because either Gary has amazing skills that we have not perhaps seen very often. Mm-hmm. Or like maybe he's, you know, he's just not, his stats aren't balanced. He has min-maxed, right? Like he's just amazing at something critical. Well, we don't know. It could be behind the scenes. Maybe he's running accounting by himself, Dan. Yeah. That's a lot of work and responsibility. Yeah. Or the Time Bureau is not the most well-managed organization. And I have to say, I'm not entirely sure, especially with various things being reset and whatnot, because mm-hmm. the Time Bureau does have a somewhat high mortality rate of agents, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So that provides you a lot of cover for a Gary.
They're like, he's managed to stay alive this long. Why not?
Yeah. Well, because a lot of people probably got eaten by those dinosaurs in that one episode.
Well, what I wonder about is if Gary was like a research nerd who got promoted beyond his competence. Like, he was
because
really
so many
good-
people died.
Yeah, he was like really good in a lab, and he managed to not get killed during some particularly messy time tesseract or something. And they're like, well, since you kept a cool head here, why don't we bump you up to HQ? And he's like, all right. And did not realize that he was in over his head. But yeah, I'd love to know the recruitment of Gary. I would love to know why Ava has not just mind wiped him and set him free.
Maybe he's a clone.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a bunch of clones of Gary, and all of his deficiencies are byproducts of the cloning process. Maybe this is as good as you can get.
Is that like it's an inverted Ava, basically?
That's like the plot of that Michael Keaton movie, Multiplicity, where he keeps multiplying himself, and over time the cognitive capacity degrades.
Yeah.
I believe in Gary. I mean, I think, you know, he's also. He's mainly, you described him as this weird, sad life. It's mainly weird.
Yeah.
It's not particularly, he seems pretty joyous about it.
He's really, like, that episode where he had John Constantine playing D&D with him last year. Like, he's got friends. He's got hobbies.
He has a rich internal and external life, maybe.
And he's really comfortable with who he is, which I like about him. You know who he reminds me of is Jared from Silicon Valley.
Yes, there's a lot of Jared in him.
There's a lot of Jared from Silicon.
Jared is a lot sadder, though. So that's
far sadder.
The details about Jared that come out, like the episode where he screams German in the night, and you're like, oh, of course. You know, we're going to find out that maybe Gary is just really weirdly fluent in ancient languages, and so they always send him in to clean up stuff in Moorish Spain or something. but yeah, every week there's like an Gary incident, and I am pretty sure that the writers really love writing Ava, just verbally eviscerating him week after week, because it's just a fun dynamic to watch on screen. But Gary, my man. Like, do you think Gary is going to be overjoyed that he has a work buddy with Nate?
Well, it seems like that would make for some comedy.
Yeah.
I mean,
especially as far as we know, there aren't really any other characters in that office with names. There's clearly many people, but you know, none of them matter.
They get killed so regularly. Well,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. We never really quite solved why there aren't more clones in the Time Bureau either. I mean, there's just Ava, and I guess Rip somehow covered that up, but it seems like that really helps your manpower problem. Just keep,
true.
Yeah. Just keep getting clones.
I think that, yeah, I get probably cloning intensive. There's probably something horrible about it. Yeah. Are clones allowed to interact with other clones of themselves? Because that's a problem, right? That's probably bad for their self-awareness, right?
Mm-hmm. So make each one wear like a funny mustache.
Yes.
Different hat.
Dan, that's demeaning to clones. But yes, that is an appropriate way to deal with them. So.
Well, you know how in boy bands they have all the different roles. This one's the bad boy. This one's the nice one. Mm-hmm. This one's the sensitive one. You can do that with the clones, where this clone's the rebel. This clone's the buy the books one. This clone's 3 days from retirement. This clone.
I haven't watched all of it, but I think we just reinvented Orphan Black.
Only with comedy this time.
Like, Orphan Black's pretty funny at times. Yeah, so. Yeah.
No, I think the reason I like this show a whole lot is just it leans in hard to the lunacy, and I can appreciate that. Because again, you have a fairy godmother in Salem. Mm-hmm. And just you wrap your brain around that, because it's you've dropped magic into a nest full of religious fanatics. That's gonna end well. And I was like, this must also be their Halloween-themed episode, too, since there's a lot of witches and princesses running around on Halloween.
Yeah, the A-plot in this episode is interesting in that I think we get a deeper look into Zari than we've gotten in the past. we also see her at one point, like, you know, going dark, pretty dark side mm-hmm. on a bunch of the people in Salem, where she sucks all the air out of the room.
Yes.
And basically yeah. is like strangling people, and seems, you know, it takes her a little bit to come back to it, which I think mm-hmm. is, again, a hint at perhaps where that character is going. I don't know. Like,
yeah.
Is she willing to, you know, what is she willing to do to the timeline or mm-hmm. to the people to basically, you know, follow her, what she believes is her moral compass?
Yeah. Because she's pretty open about having one that's informed by her background and her upbringing.
Yeah.
Also, they basically burned down the amulet. She retrieved her stone, and that was about it. So I don't know if the costume department was like, yeah, it's time to shake it
up. That's good, because that amulet was pretty ugly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They all
very
were.
Very conspicuous.
They all were. Let's
sometimes the cost, like, some things on this show are done really well. Like, they spend mm-hmm. some good money on the CGI budgets. I thought the unicorn was really well done. The fairy godmother was really well done. But, like, some of the costuming occasionally is like, guys, you know, we're watching this in HD, right? Like, it's just not going to cut it.
Yeah. No, I keep thinking costuming for this show has got to be a nightmare, because, you know, these poor people have like 10 days or whatever to source this stuff and turn it around. And they're like, you want me to find disco outfits for how many people?
Yeah, I do appreciate that now the only person who seems to have any sort of vestige of like a superhero outfit seems to be mm-hmm. Rey,
yeah.
pretty much.
Yeah.
Everybody else is kind of like, yeah, yeah, superpowers, but I'll just wear whatever's handy.
Yeah. I mean, Mick's superpowers are basically a gun and a willingness to use it.
Mm-hmm. So, yep.
so we've got that, and Nate's superpowers are CGI powered, more or less, because he had
an outfit, which I'm glad that they scrapped.
Yeah,
that was terrible.
Yeah,
it was not great.
It looked like something you'd see in like some sort of apocalyptic roller derby, like not regular roller derby, but like thunder derby or something, where there's like mm-hmm. spikes on the skates and Kurt Russell has to free somebody who's like skating with a bomb on their back, and that was the general vibe.
Yeah, it had very much that kind of comic book outfit.
Yes, exactly.
What is the functionality of this?
Yeah,
right. Like mm-hmm. because, yeah. What are you trying to say with this?
Right, and the fact that like when you take it from the pages of a comic book into real life, it doesn't mm-hmm. translate.
And materials
well.
Don't. Yeah. And comic books have gotten better at that. I mean, I feel like they've gotten more into the like, what would this outfit actually look like? I think about the redesign of the Batgirl costume recently as like,
yeah,
we want to make something that, you know, I don't know. And maybe that's a product of like more and more people cosplaying stuff and seeing photos of things. It was like, but this felt like we want to design something that could exist in the real world.
Yeah.
And yeah. And his outfit felt more like, yeah. you know, that would have looked great in primary colors printed mm-hmm. on a page in the 80s. But, yeah.
Right, and then you know, Sarah and Zari, both neither of them really have. We only made mm-hmm. Zari wear an outfit like twice, and that was probably for the best, because
that was pretty terrible. Yeah, no. And Sarah's basically like, well, she's gonna hurt people no matter what she's wearing, so she's fine. So
yeah, that was a great FYI is a thing we should tick the box for every mm-hmm. week. Sarah getting a kick-ass fight scene.
Yes,
I will say hers was pretty good this week, and mm-hmm. Katie Lotz's stunt work is as always excellent. Although the wire level stunt work that they did in one mm-hmm. part was like, that's a little ridiculous, but I'm gonna let you have it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It did feel a little bit like a throwback to season one of Legends of Tomorrow, where it's like, fixing the timeline's really hard. Let's punch everybody.
Yeah. So we can punch our way through to chronological correctness.
Yeah. We've been trying real hard to do things by the book.
No.
Yeah.
No, because one of the things that, you know, I always try to remember is when you start a show, like the first four or five episodes are usually just kind of like table setting for the season and trying to figure out what you're going to set up for payoffs. And these guys have what, 18 episodes, 16 episodes? It's not a huge episode.
16 this year. Yeah.
16. And I think it's 8 and 8, right? Like, yeah. I think we get 8 and then we get 8 in the spring.
So I'm not clear if they're going to do two distinct arcs where like Nate is kind of backbenched for this one and then he pops to the fore in the back 8 or what the deal is. But I feel like this John Constantine thing, since we've gotten two mentions in a row of how awful it is that this thing is after him, like I feel like that's kind of going to be our thing, where, oh my god, something awful is after him, and the team figures out a way to deal with it, because they'll be like, well, we took down Mollus, we can do this. But I'm also trying to figure out where they're going to take the other characters this year too. I mean, because all of them, with the exception of Mick, usually have like some sort of personal journey they go on over the course of the season. Mick stays Mick.
There's not, and that's fine. You know what? It's not worth it to really investigate. Yeah.
No, not everybody has to grow and learn and hug. You know, sometimes you can just eat a sandwich and set things on fire.
That's my motto.
Yes, exactly. So we're going to keep an eye out for future O'Gary moments. I believe next week we get to go to Punk Rock London.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I think it might be Disco London. You got to watch out for that.
Well, it's going to be hilarious either way with Ray, because Ray is not somebody I can see actually gracefully blending into the 1970s.
Just send Constantine. He looks like he walked out of the 1970s punk rock London scene.
That was the whole point to him. The whole point to him. So, yeah. And I believe they have they hinted at Constantine being immortal or having a longer life than usual in this iteration?
They haven't, I think, in this incarnation, but there is.
Usually that's the whole idea, is that he's mortal and ages in real time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But they did point out that the fairy godmother says that everybody, you know, she knows who he is, right? Which is another, I think, kind of a trope from the comic books, is that, like, he is fairly well known in the demonic circles, and that everybody kind of has messed with John Constantine. At one point,
and the fairy godmother chooses to go to hell rather than deal with the thing that is after him.
Exactly.
Seems extreme.
Yeah, which is why I think that's going to end up being our big bad this year in some way, shape, or form.
Well, I'm still wondering if it's going to be some ridiculous twist or something, right? Where it will be a bad, big bad. But I mean, given that this is a show where we saw them fight a giant stuffed animal fighting a demon,
right?
I'm prepared for the big bad to have a ridiculous appearance.
Well,
we had a Bebo sighting too in this episode.
Yes, we did.
Blocks.
Yes.
I like also they just gave an iPad to a pilgrim woman, or not pilgrim, Puritan woman from sit here
in play the 1600s. Yeah.
But I was going to say, it does seem like if they went back, I agree with Tony. I'm waiting for a twist, because we had Malice last season, so it feels like kind of going back to the same well to have another demon as the big bad. So I'm kind of curious to see how they mix that up a little bit.
I think you're going to have Nora Dark involved somehow too, and that's where Ray will get his emotional stakes this season.
Yeah, I believe that. She's going to reappear at some point here.
Yeah.
It was a bit surprising. We didn't even hear a mention of her in this episode.
No, I think they're going to remind us every once in a while. She'll be like a surprise reveal at the end of some episode where either she saves everyone's bacon or makes something worse. And there'll be like the dramatic music swell, and then bum, 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 it's Nora. And Ray will be like, hi, Nora. And everyone else will roll their eyes. You know.
We're practically writing
this
show.
You can see it, right?
I'm very hung up on what is worse than hell. So.
Yeah, I know. Do we do they have the CGI budget for it?
Yes.
All right. Well, that should be it. We did Flashcast, and I think that's sufficiently flashy for a Flashcast. I want to thank everybody who tuned in. Once again, I'm Lisa Schmeiser, and with me tonight were Dan Morin.
Thanks.
And Tony Sindelar.
Goodbye, nerds.